se, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25th, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent US President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a US company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends. And it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past. Something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed, and after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again, the one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
In the limelight.
Authorities in Tennessee on Sunday, 27th of December, named 63-year-old Nashville resident Anthony Quinn Warner as the perpetrator of the Christmas morning bombing that injured three people and destroyed sections of the city's historic downtown. Anthony Quinn Warner, an information technology contractor from the southeastern suburb of Antioch, instigated and was killed in the explosion, according to law enforcement sources at an evening press briefing. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled Nashville Blast: Officials Identify Anthony Warner as the Bomber. Stay with us for more of Richard Luscombe's article. Authorities in Tennessee on Sunday, 27th of December, named 63-year-old Nashville resident Anthony Quinn Warner as the perpetrator of the Christmas morning bombing that injured three people and destroyed sections of the city's historic downtown. Anthony Quinn Warner, an information technology contractor from the southeastern suburb of Antioch, instigated and was killed in the explosion, according to law enforcement sources at an evening press briefing. Anthony Warner is the bomber, Don Cochran, U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Tennessee, said. He was present when the bomb went off, and he perished in the bombing. Investigators matched DNA from human tissue found at the site to samples collected from a vehicle used by Warner, according to David Rauch, director of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Additional identification was made possible from clues found at the scene of Friday's explosion, which took place at a facility owned by the telecommunications company AT&T, and which knocked out or impaired mobile phone services in several other cities. Douglas Kornesky, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Memphis field office, said a vehicle identification number found in the wreckage was from an RV motorhome that was used as a mobile bomb and was registered to Anthony Warner. There is no indication that any other individuals were involved, Kornesky said. We reviewed hours of security video surrounding the recreational vehicle. We saw no other people involved. Anthony Warner had earlier on Sunday been named as a person of interest into the explosion that took place outside a facility owned by the telecommunications company AT&T, and which knocked out or impaired phone services in several other cities. Agents from the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, have spent the weekend searching the home of Warner, who once owned a company specializing in burglar alarms. Teams of investigators continue to comb the site of the bombing on Sunday for clues, and a curfew in the center of the city was extended. Earlier, a Nashville television news channel reported that Anthony Warner worked as an IT consultant for a real estate company, Friedrich & Clark. Steve Friedrich, a realtor who contacted the FBI after hearing the man's name on a news bulletin, told WSMV that federal agents had asked him if Warner had a paranoia about 5G technology. Promoted by the right-wing cult movement QAnon, among others, the conspiracy theory makes wild claims about 5G, the next-generation technology that delivers high-speed internet access to mobile phone networks. As well as believing 5G is a spying tool of the deep state, theorists claim the technology causes cancer and helps spread coronavirus. Research by the Tennessean newspaper, meanwhile, revealed that Anthony Warner registered as the owner of the business Custom Alarms and Electronics in 1993 and was involved in a recently settled legal dispute with his family over property ownership. He was kind of a low-key to the point of, I don't know, I guess some people would say he's a little odd. He was kind of a computer geek that worked at home, Warner's next-door neighbor, Steve Schmalt, told the newspaper. Earlier on Sunday, the mayor of Nashville appeared to indicate that the 5G conspiracy theory could be relevant to the investigation. For all of us locally, it feels like there has to be some connection with the AT&T facility and the site of the bombing. John Cooper, the mayor of Nashville, said on CBS's Face the Nation, that's just local insight because it's got to have something to do with the infrastructure. The mayor of Nashville, John Cooper, has been liaising closely with federal and local law enforcement agencies conducting the investigation, and also the Republican Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, who has asked President Donald Trump for a federal disaster declaration. President Trump, meanwhile, was playing golf in Florida on Sunday, and the White House had not responded to Tennessee Governor Bill Lee's request.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم everyone. This is Mehdi, your host at Youth Station, and with me is Sister Zainab, and we're going to talk about things.
Stuff. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله. I am Zainab, and he is Mehdi, and this is Youth Station, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, other life.
Are you
forms.
Sure about your own personality?
Which one are we talking about? There's so many.
Don't scare me. But
as if everyone has multiple personalities.
Like, do you know yourself?
As if no one can ever know themselves. Thus the supplication, Allahumma arifni
nafsek.
Fainaka lam ta'arifni nafs. Yeah, I'm reversing it. Allahumma arifni nafsi. What?
Man arafa nafsa faqad
arafa. Yes.
That's what you, whoever has known himself, has identified identified his Lord.
Thus, the whatever, the hadith or the, that leads us to the supplication, that leads us to the identifying and the knowing and the discovering, you know? It's an actual milestone. It's an actual thing. You've actually reached, it's an actual objective to know yourself.
Yeah, which is very natural of me to ask a question that is worth something, you know, a real question, which is very important, you know?
I think I know aspects of myself, I know aspects of Zainab, but because I'm still evolving, still changing, still growing, you know, I'm still discovering new things about her every day, and it's mind-blowing. And at sometimes it's even draining and tiring, because if it's taking...
Do you not actively think about things like those?
What?
Do you actively...
Yes, all the time. I'm actively analyzing Zainab. I'm actively evaluating her, her thoughts, her actions, her behavior, her reactions.
So you're a third person.
In this scenario, yes. I just sit there and bask in the madness, which is Zainab sometimes, I swear. Because, and it's draining and tiring sometimes, because I say sometimes a lot. I think to myself that if it takes me this long to just know myself, I have no hope of knowing any other person in this world.
That might not be true, right? Because, for example, you are a human being, right?
And I think so. So I've been told.
Yeah. I was trying to make you feel better about yourself. Anyway, what I'm saying is, once you know yourself, it's actually easier for you to be able to know people around you,
but
right?
But it's taking me so long.
There's a narration that says that the knowledgeable person knows the one who's ignorant, because the knowledgeable person was once ignorant.
Allah, Allah.
And the ignorant person does not know the knowledgeable person.
Ever.
Because he was yeah. So in that sense, yeah, if you know yourself, it's actually easier for you to be able to get around knowing other things and other people.
Okay, maybe in 20-25 years, when I'm done knowing Zainab, I will try to know other people. How well do you know Mehdi Najafi?
I know almost
nothing about him.
That's my answer, you know.
You know almost nothing about him, because he's constantly growing and evolving and changing and learning, and you know?
Yeah.
And that's, how well do you know your child? You have a baby, right?
Yeah, I have no idea sometimes when I look at her.
It's like, have you ever looked at someone and wondered what is going on inside their head?
Yeah, and I've actually written in my diary stuff about what happens, you know. It's like what goes on in my mind when I look at them. It's insane.
So far, as much as you've known Mehdi Najafi, you've been living with him for 27 glorious years. Are there any parts of him that you think you'd want to change? Or should we even do that? Should we, like, say, should we adopt the attitude that I am who I am, you know? That's just the way I am. A lot of people are like that.
Yeah,
take
don't
it or
judge.
Leave it. Exactly. I won't change. This is just the way I am. You have to accept me for who I am, take it or leave it. Or do you think that sort of mentality is good? Is it really self-empowering, or is it sometimes self-detrimenting?
It's both. I'm going to say, yeah. There are things that you have to change about yourself, and that's positive change. And there are things that you do not and should not change about yourself. For example,
such as
your belief in God, right? Like, you can only strengthen your belief, right?
Yes,
that's a change. That's a positive change. But for example, sitting there and saying that, oh, you know, that thing hasn't been proven for me, that verse hasn't been proven for me, and hence the entire revelation is not something that I can believe in, you know, out of nowhere without any effort, because you just felt like denying something that you did not like, apparently, mm-hmm. because it didn't suit the wishes and the
demands of your lower self.
Yeah. Yeah, so you asked me which things you should not change, right?
And
yeah, these are the things that you do not change. The positive things that you've learned over years, you don't change those things.
Who's to define what's positive and what's not, though? I mean, a person who says, I am what I am, accept me for who I am, I ain't gonna change, thinks that attitude is positive too, thus never finds the need to change it. So what's the criteria for positive?
So the person who's saying I am what I am and I'm not going to change anything about it is, look, they're trying to say that, well, I'm not going to put words into their mouth, but what it seems like is they've got these things that they're inclined towards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they just almost blindly follow them, right? They go into them, whatever, you know, comes their way, just take it and they go.
Because it's comfortable.
Very convenient.
Exactly.
Isn't
they want to get out of their comfort zone. They don't want to go through that struggle of growth, because growth, gosh darn it, it always comes with pain.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Yes, it always comes with struggle. It always comes with a high degree of discomfort. And who wants that other than someone who really aspires to better themselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could.
So I feel that even regarding my positive beliefs in Allah or in the Ahlul Bayt or in whatever that could be positive, you know, they don't necessarily always have to be my doctrine. Even those things, I could still look at them in a slight light of change. You know, I could say that, yeah, I believe in Allah, but am I believing in Him the right way? Is this the way He wants me to believe? Like what you said, not necessarily change, but growth, bettering it.
Yeah, which is change, but yeah,
it's a way of change, but it's in the same length, you know. It's like
wow, horizontal growth. Well, sorry, vertical.
Vertical growth. It's a vertical growth. I'm not shifting my growth focus from my belief. I'm expanding it, you know. So everything
expansion is horizontal
and vertical. Stick with the program. Did you not study geometry?
So
my point is, everything has, I think there's room for change in everything that we are and think and believe in. And that's where improvement comes along, you know?
For example, I'm not, but someone who still does not have belief in God, right? Even for someone who does not have belief in God, even that person, right? If you're you have a personality today, and tomorrow you're completely different. You have completely different values. So you've got a personality today, and tomorrow you've got a completely different personality, 180 degrees, right?
Yeah.
And even a person who has no belief in God and does not believe in religion, an atheist, say, or an agnostic, right? This person, I don't think he has that sense of respect for you, because you are no one. Practically,
yesterday
you
were.
Sorry.
In their eyes.
No, even like in society. Yesterday you were someone else. Today you're someone else. Mm-hmm. The day after you're completely different, right? Mm-hmm. And I do not know who I am interacting with, right?
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. So yesterday,
a person who's constantly shape shifting.
Yeah, the values differ, like from yesterday to today. Yeah, right. Something that you saw that was wrong in yourself, you changed that. Fair enough, but everything. Right? This is what I'm trying to say. Like,
no principles.
Yeah, no principles. So you're a slave to everything that just comes your way, right?
Totally whimsical. It's like that quote that says, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for everything.
Yeah. Who said that? That's actually nice.
I know. It's really good. I don't know who said it. It could have been me.
Which it isn't.
I could say such intelligent things. But, yeah, that's basically what it is. A person who doesn't have any principle. I'm pretty sure we have a hadith about it, too. I can't remember the hadith right now.
Imam Hussain alayhi salam.
There we go. I knew there was a hadith.
Yeah, it is sort of a hadith. The people in front of Imam Hussain alayhi salam who were about to fight him, this is what he said to them. In lam yakun lakum deen, fakunu ahraran fi dunyakum.
There we go. If you have no religion, be free men at least.
Be free men. Have values. Have a personality. Have an identity, right?
Should we or should we not change our personality?
So you have to have certain values, right? But as you said, I don't know if you did, but I'm trying to sound modest, which is that where do these values
come from? That's very important. Where do these values? You know, I think about that quote from Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam often. And I think to myself, is religion prerequisite to being a good person, or just being a good person within itself is a value and it's a prerequisite to being a good person? Because Abu Abdullah basically said, even if you don't believe in God, be a good person. So that means that you don't necessarily have to believe in God to be a good person, and you being a good person does not necessarily depend on you believing God for it to be valuable. Catch my drift? Did you just get what I just said? You know what I'm trying to say, bro?
Yeah. You can be a good person, but you're far off perfection, right? That's there. Mm-hmm. That you're not perfect. You cannot reach perfection in the sense, in the true sense.
Can anyone ever reach perfection?
Can anyone ever reach perfection? 14 people have reached
perfection. They were created perfect. That's different.
We're going to go off the topic if we go into the
Definitely we are. But aside from the infallibles, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, normal people, you know, laymen like us, mere mortals, can we reach perfection? Is that something that we should be even aspiring for?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, at least you know where this perfection is and where you're headed, right?
Mm.
And that's the only way. Which is the only way to actually believe, right? Is the only way you can actually head for that perfection.
To determine it for yourself and head toward it. You know, set it as your destination, that perfection. So basically, in changing myself and my personality, the idea is to set a goal for myself, set something as my example, my definition of, okay, perfect, destination, objective, aim, right?
Yeah.
You imagine that right now. And then do whatever I can, alter whatever I can within myself, improve whatever I can within myself, change in order to reach that goal and goal of perfection.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah,
that's the only scenario where change makes sense and is good.
Yeah, that is.
Can we agree on that?
Yeah, yeah. There's something that is very the quote, "Do in Rome as the Romans do."
Yes, right? When in Rome, do in the Romans. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't believe in that, but okay.
Oh, you have to believe in that to some extent, you know. For example, slurping your soup might not be very polite in one culture,
mm-hmm.
and it's
in
very
another culture. Yes, it's like actually a compliment to the chef.
You know, so that's something which might not be strictly in terms of, jurisprudent religious teachings of your of Islam. But that is something that you do change in yourself, right?
And we see that often in youth that move to other countries, whether they are children of immigrant families or they move to another country to study, to start a new life, to work.
Where exactly the term culture shock comes in.
Yes, right.
They have no idea. And it takes them a while to settle into that atmosphere,
and
right?
And adapt
and change certain things.
So
about
what
themselves.
Are those certain things that they should change?
For example, smiling, being polite and stuff like that.
So are you saying that the country they came from, smiling is not considered as being polite and they shouldn't be polite?
Yeah, for example, I've heard that over-smiling in a certain country is putting someone down. There's a fancy word
mocking?
For it. Undermeaning someone. And trying to imply that you're a bit dumb and stupid, right?
Silly.
So
smiling in some countries means you're silly.
You're silly, for example,
what
right?
What kind of a bitter country is that?
Or, for example, even in America, right? In America, for example, if you use big words and
yes.
someone doesn't know the big words,
they feel
it's
like,
be like
you're being smart. And
trying
you know,
to be, you know,
yeah.
show them. These
them
things,
down.
Yeah, you have to change these in yourself, right? But as we said in the beginning, you don't drift off from the real deal, right?
The
actual thing.
And okay, that's not necessarily just in America though, you guys. So, like, a lot of people feel like
mostly
if another person's
America,
using,
think,
hey,
yeah,
we're not trying to be racist here. We love all people.
Everyone.
That's all the time we have for today's show on Youth Station. Who opened? You opened.
Yeah, I opened, and someone's trying to steal the show, which is why I'm going to end this program right now because I
before
have the authority.
Usurped it.
Until next time, Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh, and the show's over.
My love. My life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing the to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Britain has clinched a narrow Brexit trade deal with the European Union, ending months of disagreements over fishing rights and future business rules. The post-Brexit trade deal was reached on Thursday, 24th of December, just a week before the UK exits one of the world's biggest trading blocs in its most significant global shift since the loss of the British Empire. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson held a press conference and confirmed the agreement, which means it escaped a chaotic finale to a tortuous divorce that has shaken the 70-year project to forge European unity. Boris Johnson called on Britons to make the most of what he called the country's soon-to-be status of a newly and truly independent nation. A deal had seemed imminent for almost a day, until haggling over just how much fish the European Union boats should be able to catch in British waters delayed the announcement of one of the most important trade deals in recent European history. The United Kingdom formally left the European Union on 31st of January, but has since been in a transition period under which rules on trade, travel and business remain unchanged until the end of this year. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Molly Blackall and Nadeem Badshah. The piece is titled, Johnson urges Tory MPs to back Brexit deal as full text published. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Molly Blackall and Nadeem Badshah's article. The European Union and the United Kingdom government have published the full text of the Brexit trade deal less than a week before it is due to be implemented. As Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson urged his backbenchers to support the agreement when it reaches the House of Commons next week. The deal, which comes to more than 1,250 pages, will be voted on in the House of Commons on Wednesday, 30th of December, just a day before the Brexit transition period ends. The Prime Minister urged Conservative Eurosceptics to back the deal, saying it made good on every one of our manifesto commitments, and he implored them to remember what the public wants us to do. With Labour Party's backing, the deal is likely to be passed, but Boris Johnson is keen to win over the European Research Group, a parliamentary pressure group of hardline Conservative MPs who want a clean break from Europe. The group has said it will reconvene what it describes as its Star Chamber, a panel of lawyers who scrutinised former Prime Minister Theresa May's withdrawal agreement in 2019 to examine the trade deal before deciding whether to back it. The chairman of the Star Chamber said its examination of the deal was underway. Sir Bill Cash said he was in the constant communication with the rest of the group, having received the full text of the treaty by courier from No. 10 Downing Street on Boxing Day. In a WhatsApp message sent by Tory MPs, Boris Johnson said he was confident the deal would withstand ruthless legal scrutiny from the Star Chamber legal eagles. Saturday, 26th of December, the former Conservative Cabinet Minister Theresa Villiers told BBC Breakfast, I very much hope this treaty stands up to scrutiny and I hope to be able to support it, but I was elected on a manifesto which promised to get Brexit done, so I need to read the document before I can work out whether this actually enables us to do that, or whether it traps us in the regulatory orbit of the European Union. The European Union's 27 member states have indicated they will formally back the deal within days. EU ambassadors were briefed on its content by Michel Barnier, who led Brussels' negotiating team in the talks with the United Kingdom. After a highly unusual meeting on Christmas Day, with at least one diplomat wearing a Santa hat and another a festive jumper, they agreed to write to the European Parliament to say they intended to take a decision on the provisional application of the deal. Downing Street's chief Brexit negotiator David Frost hailed the so-called beginning a moment of national renewal and claimed the deal ensures the UK sets its own laws again. David Frost said, "The way we've achieved this, that there is no more role for the European Court of Justice, there is no direct effects of European Union laws, there's no alignment of any kind, and we are out of the single market and out of the customs union, just as the manifesto said we would be." David Frost claimed, "This should be the beginning of a moment of national renewal for us. All choices are in our hands as a country, and it's now up to us to decide how we use them and how we go forward in the future." According to a BBC report, the deal goes beyond the bloc's so-called Canada-style trade accord. The document, which includes about 800 pages of annexes and footnotes, reportedly includes a late compromise on electric cars. The European Union has sought to offer tariff-free access only to those British vehicles that are made mostly with European parts. This measure will now be phased in over 6 years, but is less generous than the UK had requested. There is also a commitment not to lower standards on the environment, workers' rights and climate change, with mechanisms to enforce this. There is a mutual right to rebalance the agreement if there are significant divergences in future that are capable of impacting trade. The dispensations go beyond standard free trade agreements such as those between the European Union and Canada or the European Union and Japan, reflecting the United Kingdom's history in the single market, which was established in 1993. The Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove suggested the agreement would provide a fresh start for the United Kingdom and the European Union, enabling them to build a special relationship between sovereign equals. Writing in the Times, Michael Gove said he hoped it would spell an end to the rancorous and at times ugly politics seen since the European Union referendum. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer is facing the prospect of a revolt within his own party after instructing MPs to vote in favour of the deal. Sources confirmed to The Guardian that several frontbenchers were likely to resign over the vote. Many Labour MPs had urged Keir Starmer to recommend abstaining in the vote, warning that he would be unable to criticise the government for the economic consequences of the deal if Labour Party supported it. But Keir Starmer said leadership is about taking tough decisions in the national interest and being a serious, responsible opposition. He said, "At a moment of such national significance, it is not credible for Labour to be on the sidelines." Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, suggested on Saturday morning, 26th of December, that his party was likely to vote against the deal. Ed Davey said, "If the details turn out to be what we're hearing, we cannot support it." He added, "This will be so bad for British business, so bad for families to mean they're less safe. How can a responsible party support such a bad deal?" Davey also expressed concerns that the deal would make it more difficult for law enforcement bodies to share information. He said, "British families will be less safe as a result of this deal. The criminals will be cheering as a result of this deal. That's not acceptable."
Around the world with reporters. Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies. The Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its 3rd hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a 3rd corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system. Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a's airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen.
Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high costs and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's been almost 1 year since the U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the assassination of head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The martyrdom of Haj Qasem, along with head of the Iraqi Popular Forces Haj Abu Mahdi Muhandis, has had a major impact on the region, and specifically Lebanon. The images on the streets of Beirut reflect the news which became general knowledge after his assassination. His role as a representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran in assisting the resistance was instrumental.
Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said this, that he was one of the fathers, the main fathers of the victory of the year 2006. And also what followed after that was the training and the equipment that the Islamic Resistance got, that the Israelis are now quite fearsome of.
Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in several speeches that the U.S. crime will not go without punishment, stressing that the martyrdom of Haj Qasem will only strengthen the resistance alliance.
We admit that it was a heavy blow to our resistance alliance. In this life, it was a loss for us, but God Almighty has kept the family and friends and beloved people of Haj Qasem Soleimani for us. Also, the blood of Haj Qasem Soleimani will strengthen and reinforce the path of resistance.
The leader of Al-Quds forces was seen as someone who united many fronts in the region against aggression.
Things are quite interrelated here in the region. You know, whatever happens in what country reflects on the other countries. So his role was quite major, and the act of the assassination that the Americans did was a sort of not only revenge but of a certain defeat, but also a revenge against the defeat of their brains by the brains of Martyr Soleimani.
In a gesture of gratitude, one of the municipalities in southern Beirut named one of the streets after Martyr General Qasem Soleimani, whose name has become immortalized, but what many see here as the spirit of martyrdom.
The important thing that we need to focus on from these examples, from the martyrs that are sacrificing themselves, that our ummah, our nation, is always capable of producing more, and people who have the same spirits, Martyr Suleiman's legacy was quite huge, especially with the issue of the spirit of the martyr.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only seen as a friend of Lebanon, of the Lebanese resistance, he was considered by Hezbollah's commanders and leaders as a partner of the resistance, who played a key role in achieving liberation for Lebanon the year 2000 and securing victory for Lebanon in the 2006 war. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resistant groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The
airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave.
Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in 2015, Iran has stood by the Yemeni people. General Qasem Soleimani was a key figure in the Yemeni-Iranian relationship with his anti-war stance and support for Yemen's sovereignty.
There was a strong connection between the martyr